Don't spoil me. I haven't said anything yet. My name's Charlie, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everyone. I am powerless over alcohol, my wife, the weather. I am not responsible for Hugo. And I'm powerless over you and what you think. During the next few minutes, I'm going to cover seven miracles that prove to me the work of a higher power in my life. Now, I hope they come across as miracles to you, but that really is important, as long as they appear as miracles to me, which they indeed have. You're going to have to wait for those a few minutes. And incidentally, all six doors, I've asked the housekeeper to lock them all from the outside. So, there'll be no leaving, and I'm going to hold this down to about 3 hours. You get out of here about 2 o'clock. On that subject, I will beg you to leave at 11:30 because I have to be back in Charleston and do something that I just thrill doing every year at this time, being the Christmas parade. But I have to do that. Listen. 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 That's not for you. That's for me. That's to remind me that my early contact with AA, I had the problem of listening. I could hear sounds coming out of people's mouths, but I didn't listen to what they were saying. I was looking at what they were wearing. I was checking their diction. I was checking their stories. And I was taking this inventory of them. I didn't listen. Let me give you an example of how important it is to listen. And I take this from the big book. No one can object to my reading a page out of the big book, right? We all believe everything we hear in the big book. All right. This is a true story. Always be suspicious of these stories when a guy starts off by saying, this is a true story. But it was told to me as a true story that a young AA lady just a few months in the program was having difficulty with her live-in lover and her date that she was dating, and she was getting all mixed up with trying to be all things to both people. And so she, with all these problems, she took these intimate problems to her sponsor, which was a good wise step. And her sponsor referred to the big book, which is also a very smart of the sponsor. And she said, all of these problems you're having along the lines of sex are explained very clearly in the big book. And they're on page 69. Now, I know what a lot of you are doing right now. You're saying, I can hardly wait to get back to my room and get the big book out and see what's on that page. Well, I'm not going to read that page. So this lady rushed back home. She could hardly wait to solve the problems. She knew that the AA program worked, and she just knew that would solve all of her problems. And so she found a copy of the big book, and she got it out, started opening the pages, and she sort of forgot the pages. I really don't need these glasses. It's just that sometimes my curiosity overcomes my vanity. I think I'll try it without them. Anyhow. Anyhow, instead of turning to that page that her sponsor told, and she didn't want to call the sponsor back and say, I didn't listen. I didn't hear what page you told me. I didn't listen. She kept thinking, what page was it? 96. That's right, it was page 96. So she opened the big book to page 96, and I will read from this. And here is what the big book said to solve her problems. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you have to offer. It's in the book. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic an opportunity to live and be happy. One of our fellowship failed entirely with his first half dozen prospects. She often says that if she had continued to work with them, she may not have deprived others who have since recovered on their own chance. Suppose you're making a second visit. He has read this volume and says he is prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program. Having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. Let him know you are available. If he wishes to make a decision and tells his story, but do not insist upon it if he prefers to consult someone else. Now, here's the part I like best. He may be broke and homeless. If he is, you might want to help him by getting him a job or giving him a little financial assistance. But you should not deny your family and creditors of the money you owe them. Perhaps you'll want to take this man into your home for a few nights. You see, it is important to listen and get the page right and be sure we're reading the message right. In order for these miracles to come across, as I hope they will, as miracles, you're going to have to know just a little bit about who this guy is, and I'll be very, very, very brief. Our stories reveal in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on what it was like, because if there are any other alcoholics in this room, you know what it was like. It was pure hell, a terrible, terrible way of living. We have that in common, that bond. So I'm not going to dwell on so much about what it was like. I'm going to dwell more on what has happened since I found AA. In fact, I think of my life in two parts now, before AA and after AA. I call it DAAA and after AAA. Incidentally, does anyone in here know what an AAAA is? Drunk to join the automobile club? No one knew that? All right. Very quickly, my childhood, I was born in Cajun country in Louisiana. My father was a refinery man, a boilermaker. He moved around quite often. I changed schools quite often, three times in 1 year through my elementary grades. Often did not know who my schoolmates were, and in some cases didn't even know my teacher's name. We moved a lot of times. I have a feeling on looking back on the tough depression my folks went through. I think we probably moved every time the rent came through because we did a lot of moving. I never had any roots. I never had any solid feeling of belonging in any one particular place until we ended up in the state of Kansas just as the Depression struck. Anyone here from Kansas? Okay, I want to apologize to you for what I'm about to say. Kansas is one hell of a place to spend a Depression. I can tell you that. And even in good times sometimes. I love Kansas. I spent about 9 or 10 agonizing years in that state. But I tell you, I really experienced poverty. My folks had absolutely nothing. I had to going to high school wear these denim pants that were made in the refinery. They were handed out through the welfare system, and they didn't have those rivets on the side, you know, and that was just a big sign that. That guy's on welfare. He's broke. I had this pride even as a very young person. And, oh, I hated to wear those pants. I can still remember that. And I can guarantee you, I don't have a pair of them in my house now. If I had them, I'd chop them up. But that's just one of the many things of my childhood I recall, that feeling of not having. Also, I was raised by, my mother was a disciplinarian in the family. She was rather domineering. I don't dislike her, and don't anyone feel badly because I'm talking about my mother, but her idea of a spanking was not a hand on a fanny. It was a stick about that big around across your back. And even in high school, she beat me that way. I was on the basketball team. I couldn't dress out of gym. And the coach would call me down and say, why aren't you dressed out? I'd say, well, you know, I'm just not dressed out. So he'd say, bend over, and he got his board of education, and I got another squat. So, I don't think she was the greatest mom in the world, but I don't blame her for my alcoholism, and I quit a long time ago of trying to figure out why me. I just am, and I blame no one. I just tell you this for some background. Also, Kansas was the last state in the Union to go wet. No booze out there. I didn't see my parents drink. They couldn't afford to buy bread, much less booze. So, I wasn't raised around alcohol. At age 16, I joined the Kansas National Guard. I heard they were going to camp up in Lake Mille Lac, Minnesota, and they were going to pay you $21 for those 21 days. There was a lot of money during the Depression. I thought I could buy some new clothes with rivets on them. So I joined, and I went to that camp, and it was great, you know, and I thought that was the end of it. Then I went to a drill one night, for which we were paid $1.25 once a week, and I went to a drill, and the captain said, "I've got some news for you. President Roosevelt wants us to go into federal service and to show the regular army what they should be doing." So I came back home and told my mother and father at the supper, I said, "I have something real serious to discuss." And Dad said, "All right, what is it? Hurry up." I said, "Well, I'm going to quit school and not finish the 12th grade, and I want to go with my outfit when they mobilize." Big pause. I expected a big debate. Nothing. Next words I hear were, "Pass the potatoes." Never this. One less mouth to feed. Well, I tell you, when I went in the service, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I hear people sometimes complain about the military. To me, at that point in my life, it was just the greatest thing that could happen. You got 3 square meals. You got your clothing all furnished. Somebody told you what to do. You had the camaraderie of all the other fellows. And it was just great. I just loved it. Until this little corporal started picking on me. And this little sergeant starts giving me trouble. And I thought, wait a minute. If I can get what he has, see, this is long before AA. If I can get what he has, he won't be able to pick on me. So I applied myself, and I really did study and earned it. And I was promoted to corporal, a signal corporal. And the other buddy and myself, signal corporal and myself, were practicing the semaphore flags one day. And we asked permission to go out over the reservation. Now, this was in Little Rock, Arkansas, Camp Robinson. That's before you were a baby, even. Your parents hadn't even met each other when this happened. When he was Camp Pike, that was WW1, I think. Yeah. I didn't know there was anyone older than me. I got to talk to your daddy. He didn't clean that place up very well because we spent the first month out there cleaning it up. Anyway, we were granted permission to go out and practice the semaphore flags. I'm going to somewhere with this now. Stay with me. And we practiced these, and we got pretty good at it. And we needed the semaphore because if the radio breaks down or if the telephone lines were broken with the field artillery battery, you had to have communications or, you know, people might take those cannons and start shooting each other. So we had to, this is very important. So we were out going over some of these hills, and we looked down after a couple hours, and down on the highway there was a little, in those days we called them roadhouses. Now you people call them nightclubs. But this was definitely a roadhouse. A couple little gasoline pumps in front, little store inside. They sold things, you know. So he looked at me, and I looked at him, and I said, "Yeah, let's go down there and, you know, see what happens. Get a Coke or something. Something real exciting. Get an RC and a moon pie or something." So we crawled under the fence. We crawled under the fence, went down over the hill, went down into this little place. There were 2 other soldiers down there who were obviously down there without leave. The name of the club I'll never forget was the Over the Hill Club. Wasn't that original? The Over the Hill Club. So the 4 of us were sitting in there talking, and an old farmer, real old farmer, he must have been 35 years old. This old farmer came in, and he said, "Fellas," he said, "my truck's about out of gas." You know, I thought, boy, that's a sad story. And he said, "But I've got a gallon of homemade wine, and if you guys would like to buy it, I can get enough gas, you know, to get home." So we dug through our pockets. I think we came up with something like 50 cents, and which incidentally would buy about 4 gallons of gas then. Some of the young people are going, "Oh, is that real? 12 cents a gallon." So we bought his jug of wine, and this is the first sign that, in retrospect, that I have that alcoholism was with me long before I began to drink. This was my first drink. But I appointed myself as custodian of pouring the wine. So we ordered the 4 glasses from the lady there. They hadn't bought anything from her yet, but she brought us 4 glasses. We were sitting in this little booth, and I poured them about 1.5 inches each glass, and I filled mine up. And I started drinking it, and it tasted like sort of like strong grape juice with a little tang or kick to it. And I was watching them, so before they emptied theirs, I wanted to empty mine, and I did. It was time to pour some more, so I did it again. poured mine full. Now this time, after I drank mine very quickly, it was time for the third pour, and we're getting down about that far from the end of the gallon, transparent jug. So I gave him about half an inch a piece, and I finished the rest of the wine in my glass. I chug-a-lugged that down. By then, I was feeling real great, and there's nothing to this stuff, you know. I just poured it right down. And then, very shortly, the strangest thing happened. The table in front of me flew right up and hit me in the face. I don't know why you're laughing. It really broke my nose. And it's just the way it seemed. The next thing I recall hearing was some voice saying, "Don't tear his uniform." And I realized I was being drugged on my back under a barbed wire fence. These three guys were getting me back to camp. Boy, the camp was the last place I wanted to go then, in that condition. They put me on their shoulders, so they tell me, carried me down my company street. This is just before retreat, a real famous time to be going back to your unit. The next thing I realized, the next real consciousness I had, was something very cold and very loud hitting me on the head, and I'm sitting in the cold shower, my boots are still on, my uniform's still on, and the bugler's blowing assembly for retreat, and in my outfit, if you miss the formation, they just shot you. I mean, you don't miss formations. And I became conscious for the first time. Very first experience with alcohol. I black out. I pass out. And that should have told me something, but it didn't at all. I went on and straightened up, and I think I became a pretty good soldier. I got rapid promotions. And I knew that since we mobilized on December 23rd, 1940, and we had a year to serve, I would get out on December 23rd, 1941. Boy, I just about have a year in. Well, then December 7th happened. Some of you don't know about that, but it was in all the papers. World War II was on, and they decided that maybe they'd just go ahead and keep us after promising we'd only be 1 year. 47 months later, I finally got out. After 36 months overseas, four major campaigns, and nothing really to be ashamed of in the way I performed as a soldier, though I did do my share of drinking, but everyone did. You drank to get over your fears. You drank to get over your grief at times. And then you just drank to drink. Get the hell away from what was going on. I did my share of that. But it didn't interfere with my duties. And I came out of the military feeling pretty good. First part of May, when we knew the Germans were surrendering, I was in the hospital at the time. And I began to like the way this nurse walked. I was a big boy by then, you know, I'd grown up some. I was a little 16-year-old Kansas farm boy. We started dating, and the following month we got married. Now you gotta remember, things were going 100 miles an hour. You didn't have time for these long courtships, or long goodbyes, or long hellos. And we were married. She was an army nurse. Two children out of that marriage, one adopted and one, we always told our adopted child that she was heaven made and that her brother was homemade. Strange thing is, while I love them both, of course, and of course they're grown and on their own now, but my daughter really adopted as really turned out to be the apple of my eye. She's a great little gal. I gotta get through this. Okay, let's move along. Everything went well, and the kids grew up, and we had a little house, and had a little car, and I had a little job, and we were making it, and then I noticed my wife began to drink more than just casually. When we go to a cocktail party, I'd notice that, you know, while I'm drinking one, she's drinking two, and I really wasn't into drinking a lot. I like to get that high that I once had, which I'd still like to have again, but I've never found it. It's a long time ago. She was drinking two, and then she'd drink one and put it under her coat to take to the car. And I began to get concerned. We had a few words about it, but nothing serious. And finally, she became a full-fledged alcoholic with her drinking. And I know what some... Who are the Al-Anons in here? Hold up your hand. Okay. Oh, a lot of you. I know how you Al-Anons feel in living with an alcoholic. Every siren I heard, I thought it was her having a wreck. Every news bulletin I have about a car turned over to such a place, I think, oh my God, it's her. I come home and find her passed out on the kitchen floor or in the bedroom. And some pretty rough years in there. I remember asking her, why? Why do you drink? Do you want our marriage to fall apart? Why do you drink? She says, I don't know. I said, that's not an answer. See? Can you see how that would happen? Al-Anons do. And I said, Peggy, you've got to stop drinking. She said, I can't stop. I said, that's ridiculous. Just don't drink. She says, it doesn't work that way. I have got to have a drink. Well, cunning and baffling as alcohol is, alcoholics are cunning and baffling. So I began to get these tremendous plastic card bills. And she's going through the neighborhood shopping for all the people in the neighborhood and putting it on my charge account, you know, to get the cash because they don't take credit cards, at least they didn't then, at the liquor store. Well, it got very bad. And one morning, as both the youngsters were heading off to school, my wife was down on her hands and knees on the dining room table with cups of coffee and a saucer, talking to the little people, pouring cups of coffee. And it's sad and it's funny, but it was the beginning of a first-hand, close experience of delirium tremens. And if any of you have been around anyone with DTs, or if you've had them yourself, well, if you've had them yourself, you wouldn't remember. But if you've been around anyone, it's a frightening experience. Instead of driving the kids to school, I got a neighbor to do that morning, and I got her, you know, to get up and leave the little people alone with the coffee cups. Then I heard her talking to her mother real loud in the bathroom. I went in there. There was a stack of towels she was talking to. I got her in the bedroom. I called AA. I knew a fellow in AA. He came out he says, well, first of all, call your doctor right away, and I'll be out. By now, she's seeing faces at the windows, screaming. So I called my doctor, and he says, I'll have a prescription delivered to her called Peraldehyde. And he says, all you have to do is just give her a big spoonful of Peraldehyde about every hour, and she'll be all right. I said, great, you know, whatever. So the Peraldehyde arrived. I think it was a 4 or 5 ounce little bottle. I gave her a spoonful of it, and it did seem to help her. So I relaxed for about 10 minutes until I heard this body hit the floor. She'd gone to the kitchen and chug-a-lugged the rest of the Peraldehyde. By now, things are getting serious. To make a long story short, this fellow from AA, who is now dead, God bless his soul, he was a wonderful man. He came and stayed with us and convinced her that she should try AA. And she did. Well, I used to sit in the car and wait while she'd go to her AA meetings. I took all alcohol out of the house, and I found it in the darndest places, the little pints in the flush box in the commode, in the pockets of her coats, in hat boxes. I found more pieces of bottles of booze when I searched that little house. I got all that cleaned out, all the pills cleaned out, and she got into AA. And she did very well out of her last 5 years of her life. She was sober perhaps 4 years. She had several slips of short duration, Palmetto Center a few times. And anyhow, those were pretty good years. I supported her in that, and I tell you that not for any pat on the back for me. It was easy to do. I wasn't really into drinking. I didn't have it in the house. I didn't buy it. I went to a few cocktail parties on my own, but probably in those 5 years, I may have consumed maybe a quart of booze in 5 years. Free drinks, other people's drinks. One of those things where you have to be seen and be seen. And I have to do that in my business sometimes. At least I tell myself I do. I really don't. So finally, in sitting in the car, it was recommended that I go to Al-Anon. Well, I went to Al-Anon for two different meetings. I was the only man present, and it seemed to me all the women were just talking about their spouses. I felt very uncomfortable. I only went once, didn't go back, and I didn't get anything out of it. Isn't that strange how you can't get the whole picture in 1 hour? I thought that was probably just that meeting. So I went to another Al-Anon meeting, same thing. Left, back in the car sitting. So she said, why don't you come in? This is an open meeting. So I came to the open meetings. After a while, it got cold in the car. I came to the closed meetings. I sat in the back. You didn't tell me to leave. So I sat there, and during the time that she went to the meetings, and she went to 4 or 5 a week, I would go with her, and I'd sit in the back. And then, as I do now, I admired and fell in love with alcoholics. The depths to which many of them had fallen in their stories, Alfred Hitchcock nightmarish dramas, and now they were standing there with a suit and tie and sober. God, I love those people. And I still do. Then comes the time when she's sober, and we've gone to the Citadel Delaware game, and driving back that Sunday across, I'm not sure I can really tell this, but I'll try. Driving across that big Chesapeake Bay Bridge, she began to hemorrhage very much from her mouth. I stopped at a little way station. Highway patrolman was seated in there. He said, "Follow me." And we raced to that hospital in that, what's the name of that little town? Just this side of the bridge? No, in Annapolis. This side, south of Virginia Beach. Virginia Beach, thank you. Virginia Beach Hotel, raced up to the Virginia Beach hospital, took her in, and they pulled her around and then wanted to discharge her as fast as they could after a few days. And I can see why. They didn't know what was going on. As it turned out, she had had an aortic operation. She had a graft here, and the thing had come loose and began to float, and she would hemorrhage until her blood pressure would get low, and it would stop. This went on and on for several times. But as I was driving her to that hospital, following that patrolman, she was trying to talk through this hemorrhaging, and I couldn't understand her words. So I held her head up by me, and I said, "What are you saying? What are you saying?" And she said, "Thank God I'm sober." And that really impressed me, and it still does. Well, what could have been her dying breath? She's thanking God that she's sober. That was pretty powerful stuff. She died shortly after that. And I began to drink very much, very fast, and get very drunk very often, like every night. I'd taken nearly a year off during her illness, and I didn't have anything going for me, so I just sat at home and got drunk. Now, doesn't that sound like fun? To be free to do nothing but just sit around and drink? Well, it wasn't fun. I had blackouts. I had white. I still can't figure this one out. I had one white suit. What do they call those? Leisure suits in those days. Had grass stains on the elbows and knees. I don't know how it got there. So I wondered about that for the longest time. Did I have a good time or not? I don't know. Total blackout. I finally went on back to work, which is a good thing to do, and where I worked for a few months, at the station where I'd been with a long while, they took me back, and you'd be glad to have me, and I continued to drink on and off, but I didn't let it interfere with my work. I decided to drink only on weekends. Well, we all know that weekends begin on Friday, and they run for Monday most of the time. So Friday to Monday, I was doing a good bit of nipping and drinking, especially on the weekends. Finally, it got to the point where I was nipping during the day, staying just straight enough to keep my hat on straight, do what I had to do, and then getting drunk every night. While I was doing this, I was courting my present wife, and I convinced her that she ought to try it too. It's great. And her contribution to our drinking was to introduce me to a Black Russian. Oh. You know, they make a soda pop that tastes like one of those things, and somebody brought me one of those one day at the house, and I said, "Get that thing out of here quick. I don't want to be reminded of that." But we had, I suppose, what we thought was some good drinking times. And after a couple of years of our marriage, instead of our marriage growing, as I had known from experience, a marriage is supposed to grow, ours was going the other way. And I had no idea why. I knew I was drinking too much, and I don't know that I tried to take her inventory so much, but we were both drinking too much. Things just weren't working out. To the point that I clipped out an ad of an attorney and began to think about divorce. You see, it couldn't be alcohol. It has to be something else. I don't know what the heck it was. We're not really together. As a matter of fact, our honeymoon cruise out of Miami, first, see if this is insanity. First night of our honeymoon cruise, I was so drunk on that ship that I not only could not find the stateroom, and Stacy's waiting with a black negligee. Imagine that, you guys. No, second thought, don't imagine that. That's my wife. I couldn't even find the right deck, much less the right... That's a great way to spend your first night of your honeymoon. And still, later on, I was to scream, I'm not insane. There's nothing wrong with me. That's just one of a dozen insane things. We'll move along in the interest of time. We're counting down here. Finally, a gun drove me to AA. I had reached such low opinion, low self-esteem of myself, of everything around me, with this constant drinking every night, that I came out of a blackout at around 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Who knows what time it is when you're drinking. I was in the utility room of my house, dumping out boxes, looking for my pistol. I didn't find it, thank God, because my daughter had taken it. And I don't know what I would have done with it. I do recall the faint thought of, if I find it, I just put the barrel in my mouth, and that's it. That's an end. That ends it. And suicide is a permanent solution to any temporary problem. But I, obviously I didn't do that. I wouldn't be standing here boring you people right now. But that did make me think, maybe I better call for some help. So I sat up until daylight. I didn't want to call too early. I called AA in the book. And a fellow called me back. Strangely enough, a fellow I knew. What a strange miracle there. He said, yes, Charlie, there is a meeting. It's tonight. And it's over here. You know, it's over here in Mount Pleasant. You got to come to the... You got to come to the courtroom here, the police station. Do you know where that is? I said, no, and I don't know if I want to go there. He said, yeah, it's all right. That's where we have our meetings. So he said, come early and we'll talk. I did. I went there, picked up a white ship that night. The next 2 weeks, I didn't drink. And it was just miraculous, the sudden change in the way I felt and the hope that I had for the future. After that, I worked very hard during the long telethon and thought, well, you know, this one drink thing, one drink will relax me. I'm so damn tired, I can't sleep. So I'll just get one little tiny small bottle of one drink. This was Monday night. So I had one little drink. And it didn't make me drunk. Tuesday was a meeting night in Mount Pleasant. And instead of going to Tuesday's meeting, and I was going to go, you know, not tell anybody, don't tell anyone you've been drinking, you know, one of those things. And instead of going to that meeting, I went to one of my 3 liquor stores and bought a quart. I was off on 5 weeks of the most hellish, progressive drinking of my life. If you had 2 hours and a whole lot of patience, I could paint those stories for you. When I went back the last time and picked up a white ship again, I would have crawled on my hands and knees. You know, these and how it works, very clearly states in there, if you want what we have and willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready. Then you're ready. Well, my then had arrived. And I threw myself into AA, attended the meetings rapidly, grabbed a hold of about 3 guys who I almost physically held on to them because they were sober, they were laughing, they were there at every meeting. I wasn't impressed with the fact that they'd been sober for a couple of years or so. Just sober the day and the next day they were still there. And I wouldn't even leave town. I was scared to death. And I stayed free of booze. And they said, do other things. So I went to detox. And I put my arm around the guys sitting down there shaking so hard they couldn't hold coffee. And I went to treatment centers and I got on the 12-step thing. Here I am. Who am I going to help? I've had less than 3 months. And I'm driving them around, driving them to the Palmetto Center, and I'm taking, you know, I'm going to save the world. Didn't help anybody, but one person helped me. And then one night, they called out for the 90-day chip, and I went up and picked up the red chip. I can't explain how I felt that night, because I don't think any of you here, I haven't heard anyone explain what is a higher power. How do you really feel? But I knew that something was working in my life, because my record for staying sober boys and girls, was 2.5 days. And I would try it. After a hellacious weekend of drink, I'd make it through Monday, I'd make it through Tuesday, and Wednesday noon, martini. In the middle of the second martini, I could feel every anger, every resentment, every anxiety, every jealousy in my body. I could just feel it come to the surface. I would get mad at the waitress, get mad at my wife, get mad at you if you were there, anybody. My personality was just doing that. That should have been a signal, too. It wasn't. But that was my record, 2.5 days. Now I've gone 90 days in my adult life, never before, without a drink, and I knew that a power was working. Up until that moment, it had probably been mostly the AA fellowship, but it was still working. So I kept going and kept going. And one night, you know what happened? They said, does anyone have a birthday? And I said, yes, I do. And I went up and picked up a blue chip. I'd watched other people pick these things up, and I never believed them. I thought, no alcoholic. These people are not real alcoholics like I was, because no alcoholic can go a year without drinking. But I did. I think I expected something magical to happen then, and it really didn't, except I did want that blue chip. So I had the blue chip in my pocket. 2 months later, I sort of relaxed and thought, now I can go on vacation. Now I can relax. Now I have a year. I must know it all. So we went on a vacation to one of our favorite vacation spots, which in South Florida, Punta Gorda. Any people know where Punta Gorda, Florida is, near Fort Myers? You know. Well, they've got a liquor store down there. I'm telling you, the Hollywood couldn't build a better liquor store than they have. It's almost as big as this room. The shelves have every kind of booze you can think of. They have islands of bargains stacked up in the middle. Was $9.95, now $7.25. And get this, they have shopping carts. And you got one of your shopping carts, and you just go through there and throw it up. Well, after 14 months, typical alcoholic fashion, didn't pay any attention to the word halt. Don't get too hungry, too angry, too lonely, too tired, didn't pay any attention to that. I drove all the way down there, over 600 miles. Wouldn't stop to eat. You know how a man is when he drives. Men don't want to stop. I mean, what the hell is the deal with a man? He doesn't want to stop. And you women keep screaming, I've got to stop. Eventually we get the message. But I was hungry. I was angry. I was lonely. I was certainly tired. And I was most angry because it was raining and cold and I couldn't have my toys. My swimming pool was too cold to swim in. And the little 3-year-old Brad in me said, well, I know what I'll do. This is a motel. When you're in a motel, you're supposed to drink. So I made the announcement to my wife that since we can't go swimming, I'm going back to that liquor store and I'm going to load one of those carts up and we're going to have a great vacation. Forgot everything else I had heard those 14 months within the fellowship. Paid no attention to the steps. I looked upon your reading of the steps as slowing up the meeting, taking away time, you know, when we could get to the meaty stuff, the horror stories. And I resented that. I went ahead and accepted the first half of the first step and the middle third of the 12th step. I went that far. But there's other things in here. No, I haven't got time for that. And I would certainly never in my wildest dreams ever write down all the things I've done and share them with God and another human being. I wouldn't do that. So I paid no attention to these steps. That's the reason I had that thought, that overpowering thought, by the boots. And I was up and ready to go out the door. And my wife said, Gerald, this may be one of those times when you're supposed to call AA. She was a lot smarter than I was back in those days. And as a matter of fact, she still is. So very grumpily, I said, well, all right. Call AA. Yes, there was a meeting. Yes, it was tonight. Yes, it was within eye view of the Howard Johnson Hotel. Yes, it started at 8 o'clock. All right, we'll go to the damn meeting. So you have to wonder if a higher power is working. What took place at that meeting that night? I went and I sat in the back row with my arms folded, my lip hanging down. And a lady with 5 years in the program, or 5 years sobriety, 5 years since her last drink, stood up and told her story of how the week before she had gone to a convenience store, bought just a few things, and then she went out, she bought some cooking wine, and when she got home, instead of cooking, she drank the wine, and she was off and running after 5 years. And I thought, you know, my little one-year chip may not work if in 5 years, and she's looking at me while she's talking. She'd never seen me in her life. I thought, how did she know to be looking at me like this? This was around the 20th of December, and, you know, we were visiting in-laws for Christmas. Had I drank this sign on the wall you see in many AA halls, think to drink through, there would have been no Christmas. There would have been no New Year's. There would have been no visits to the in-laws. There probably would have been no wife. And I was dangerously close to that. When I got back, I'm running along, I'm going to hurry up here. When I got back, I told this to one of my three sponsors. Huh? See, typical alcoholic fashion, I have had three sponsors. I mean, one might be good enough for you, but there's certain things I could tell this guy, and then certain things I could tell this one, and certain things I could... See, this guy goes to church, and he can only hear certain things, and... So I told this one sponsor what I'd done, how close I'd come to drink. He says, Charlie, how long have you been in the program? I said, well, you know, my 14 months, you know, I got a blue chip. And he said, well, what do you, I said, well, you know, I go to these meetings and I go to detox and I go talk to people, you know, and I got 12 step people and things. He says, where are you in the program? I said, well, you haven't heard me. You know, I do this. I just, he said, where are you in the program? And I said, what do you mean program? He said, what step are you on? And I said, well, I just, and he had me. And he referred me to that section of the big book that says there will come a time in the life of every alcoholic when no human power will keep him from that drink. And he said, you better get serious. You better get serious about this or you're not going to make it. Scared me because I hung on his words. He's a guy I just listened to. And so he got me started on the steps. And when I came to the fourth step, after having done the other three, it was very easy to get to the second step because staying sober for over a year, I had to come to believe a power greater than me existed. Hey, and boys and girls, if a greater power than me doesn't exist, you are in heap big trouble, all of you are. It just really comes down to believing either there is a God or there isn't a God. And you take the choice. If you want to do it all on your own, which is what I was doing, I was getting nowhere fast. That's an early grave. So I took those steps. When I wrote my fourth step, I sometimes wish I'd have saved them and mimeographed them and passed them out in a meeting like this and just let you read and take my name off of it so you don't know the word. And ask you how old the guy is who wrote that. You would say 12. If you're real generous, you may say 14. But as I read these things over and over, it was about 2 weeks before I could take the fifth step with my sponsor, and as I kept reading these over, and I hid them under the mat in the trunk of the car. You know, I had them there, I had it locked up. Nobody get to that. As I kept reading them over, I'd think, no, wait, now, is this right or not? Is this really right? And I'd read this paragraph. Yep, that's right. Well, what about it? And there was nothing I could delete. In fact, they even added some things in between lines. So I went and took the fifth step with him, laid on the floor of his apartment. He sat in a chair looking at the ceiling. Hour later, I'd been through everything. And he said, you know, that's bad, but he said, I've done those things too. And I'm sober now. And I've been sober 12 years. And you can make it. I needed to hear that. I wasn't the only one in the world that did those things. And then moving to the other steps became vitally important. The spiritual awakening and the contact with a higher power with me is something that is personal and private, but very real. And I can't explain it to you. If I could, you know, I'd write a book about it and make $1 million, or I'd take someone who's having trouble with this concept and convince them maybe and save their lives. Now, here are the miracles I talked about at the beginning, and I'm wrapping this up. I'm already 5 minutes over. These, to me, are miracles in my life. The last time I went to pick up a white chip, I picked up this was the third white chip I picked up. 30 days after that, our house burned down. You ever wonder what you take if your house is on fire? I used to do that. I don't know what you would take, but that night, my only concern, we were out having dinner, we were celebrating my wife's belly button birthday, and it was our 30 days in AA. And as we raced back and the fire engines were there, all I could think of was my dog, and the neighbors next door had gotten her out and had her all right. So I went in with the firemen with their axes blazing and the water that deep on a brand new wall-to-wall carpet we just put in, all this madness. I got my insurance box, my wife's jewelry box. And I picked up that book, and I left. And I just said, the hell with it. Neighbors were trying to save clothes. They're throwing things out in the yard. I just said, the hell with it. So we went to spend the night with two people we'd gone to the Bahamas with quite a bit, drinking buddies. They owned their own plane. And we got to their apartment that night. They fixed themselves a drink. And they walked into the bedroom. And they said, Charlie, what would you like? I said, a glass of water. I had my dog in my lap with a blanket. She was coughing up. Ashes. That's how I spent the night. Now that has to be a miracle. Any reasonable person with any sense at all would say, my God, bring me anything to drink. You know? All our clothes wiped out. Pictures of 4 years wiped out. It was a mess. But I didn't drink. To me, that is a big miracle. Second time is a, gosh, I'm running late. I'm 22 till. I want to wrap this up. I'll skip a few of these miracles. Just believe me, they're here. I do want to tell you about after I had these 14, 15, 16, 17 months, and I'm feeling better and better about it, the company decided I should attend a severe weather warning hurricane conference held out in Norman, Oklahoma, the university. So they signed me up, and they said, would you go? I said, yeah, I'll go. As the time got close, I thought, wait a minute. I ain't never been out of town by myself in a motel a long way from home. And you know, I've heard it said that alcohol gets more baffling and powerful the farther away from home you get. And but they bought the tickets and everything was set and I had to go. So a couple of nights before that, I attended a meeting over on Breach Inlet. And this is important, I think, to everyone who's new. And I said, hey, I'm worried. A couple of days, I've got to go to Oklahoma and be out there 3 days. And I just am afraid, you know, to go. And I still had to go. My job required it. And a young sailor, 2 weeks in the alcohol rehabilitation center, leaned across the table and says, Charlie, you're not going out there alone. Well, you should know about me that I'm a follower, not a leader. My wife, she knows what time, what gate, all this stuff. I never pay any attention to all that. I just follow, you know. And she says, go over here, stand in line. I stand in line. So before we left, I began to get worried. I said, Stacy, really, I don't know if I can... I had to go through Dallas-Fort Worth. Anyone going through Dallas-Fort Worth and, wait a minute, and change planes? When the plane you're changing to is Braniff, who's on the way down? So she said, I'm only going to write a little sticker. Please help this man. Well, going out west and going to Oklahoma, of course, I had to wear my cowboy boots and my denims, you know, man, you know, typical alcohol. You got to do that. So I pull all those things on. I had my suit for the meetings and everything packed, and I had my big book, and Stacy had already gotten the list of all the numbers to call. Boy, I'm all set. Get on the plane. Off I go. Dallas, Fort Worth. Get off the plane, walk in that monstrous place, and I'm following everybody, and we keep walking, walking, walking. You know, most any man hates to ask directions anyhow, but an alcoholic. So I finally thought, I haven't got but about 15 minutes to get to that next plane. I'd better ask somebody. I'm not going to find it following this bunch of clowns around the cars. So I went to this desk. I said, how do we get there? She said, get on the stairs, uniform. Take the yellow car and pay in. Okay. I could follow him. I got downstairs, and the speaker came on. The yellow car is on the surface. You must take a bus to the concourse such and such. You know, I'm getting confused by now because I've never done that. I really haven't. I always follow people. Finally, a taxi pulled up and let someone out. I said, you know where Branagh is? The guy says, yes, I know where Branagh is. I said, take me there quick. And he says, well, it'll be $5. I said, I don't care. Take me. He takes me to the bottom of this huge ramp and he says, Branagh's up there. I said, well, take me to Branagh. He said, it'll be $6. I said, I don't care if it's $20. Get me up there quick. He got me up there. Just got on the plane. Went to the Will Rogers airport there in Oklahoma City and finally, through some strange miracle, went down and found where the luggage was. Well, it's going around and around and around. And I look around, I'm the only one standing there. And that turntable just keep going around. No luggage. That's number one. Well, that didn't throw me too much. Then the phone call says, Stacy, I don't have any luggage. She said, well, just, you know, go to the place and make a claim. That car reserved to get to Norman's. I went to the car desk, showed her my papers. She said, go out there and get a Fritzenheimer. You know, I don't know what these new cars are called. Back in my day, it was either a little Chevy or Ford or something. But she said some name or something. I went out there. There must have been 20 acres of cars. Frustration number two. So finally, I stopped the guy long enough to say, help me find this car. He said, it's in row 8. It's 26 in row 8. Now, all right, we find it. Then I say, how do I find Norman, Oklahoma? He said, you go up here, you turn right, turn left there, you go up on the solar pass, and you get right on it. He didn't tell me that when you get up there, unless you get in the right lane, you go around that thing about 20 minutes. I'm not sitting at all well by now, but I did that. Finally got on the road, finally got to a motel, went to check in the motel. She says, Mr. Who? Mr. Hall. We don't have any reservation for you. Now, the company is supposed to take care of all this. Oh, you must have. No, you don't. Well, but we can fix you up. I started to use that one. You'd have a room if the president was coming. Well, he ain't coming. Give me his room. I started to use that one. But she gave me the room, and I got checked in, called Stacy again. Here I am sitting in denim and cowboy boots. The meeting's the next morning. No luggage. No big book. And she said, well, start calling these numbers. I called 5 times. This is a recording. I'm right now. If you just leave your message, you know. Boy, did I hit recording, especially when you're desperate. Finally, one of them did call me back, though, and say, yes, there's a meeting at such and such a street, 130th Street, 130 blocks on this street. So I thought, well, I think I can find that. Stacy called me back. Everything was fine. Got ready to go to the meeting that night in my denims. And when I leaned over the laboratory, immaculately clean, beautiful room, as I leaned over the laboratory to brush my teeth, in my peripheral vision, I swear, half bottle of scotch sitting in the corner. Back to the phone. Stacy! I think a wife ought to take care of her husband. I don't know what's the fun of it. She says, well, pick the bottle up and pour it down the drain and let the water run through it and throw the bottle in the trash. Okay. Well, hold the phone a minute. Drove in town real quickly, and I was so proud I found that street. And I turned right, and boy, it was right on time. The meeting's at 8 o'clock, and it's only 20 minutes till 8. Boy, I'm tooting along there, and the streets are going by, looking for 130th block, and I find it. And I look around, the filling station on that corner, vacant lot here, a bank which was closed on this corner, and a big shed, the storage shed here. I'd gone the wrong way. It was 130 blocks back that way after I went back. It was not a good day. So by then, I thought, well, I don't want to be conspicuous and come in late to this meeting, so I'll just go on back. And as I drove back, I stopped, and I got a pint of ice cream. From the Howard Johnson, went up and sat in the middle of bed, took off my shoes, and I called Stacy. Told her what I'd done. Went to the meeting the next morning at the university. They said, who? We don't have you registered at all. I said, you don't? No, we don't. I thought, well, that suits me fine. So although I had a rented car, and I was only 200 miles from my old hometown up in Kansas, so I thought, well, I'll just spend these 3 days up there. And I did. And I enjoyed it. And I went to an AA meeting. And they even asked me to talk. So it was a great trip. I'm running out of time, and I have some more things here, but I've got to stop. I just want you people to know I love every one of you in a special way that only one AA can love another. And I know I'm not what I should be. I don't think I'm what I could be. But thank God I'm not what I used to be.